Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. This week we are looking at Inception, the film that Sarah Palin thinks is about teen pregnancy. And I'm joined on the line by Jason Diamond. How are you, Jason?
Excellent. I actually love that joke.
And Matt Walden, how are you, Matt?
Very good. Hanging out in San Francisco this week.
So I'm really keen to catch up with you guys. I might catch up with what you guys have been up to at the end of the show, because Inception is a film that, quite frankly, I've been looking forward to doing the VFX show for before I even saw the film, and then after it particularly so. So let's start, as we always do, with a quick rundown on the film, what we think of it. Then we're going to discuss the VFX, and also I want to discuss with you guys a little later in the show the idea of doing stuff in camera, doing stuff old school, doing stuff chemically as opposed to digitally, which is some of the aspects that were decisions made by the director. But let's start, as we do, with just a quick rundown of what we think of the film. And Matt, I'm going to throw to you first. Is it a film that you enjoyed? How did you rate it?
I really liked it quite a bit, actually. It's my favorite kind of film, in that I think, you know, for people who really love going to the movies, this is and really love film and filmmaking, I think it's great. It's 2001 is probably one of my favorite all-time films, and I think this shares a lot of DNA with 2001 in terms of, things that I think we'll probably get into talking about. But I really liked it. There were a few things about it that I didn't like that we can also talk about, but for the most part, I thought it was a great movie. I really enjoyed it.
And Jason, what did you think of Christopher Nolan's first original script in a while?
I loved it. It's not a perfect film, but for effort, and especially under the sometimes crippling guise of a $160 million film, you don't often get to do whatever you want, even though you think you do, that kind of money. And I think he did an awesome job. I mean, I was blown away. Other than I didn't really like the snow stuff too much. It felt like For Your Eyes Only a bit.
Well, I think it was meant to. But, this is I love this film. This is a film that's an intelligent heist film. And there are so many aspects of this film that we can discuss. So before we get into the visual effects, let's hit on a couple of those. As I said, from a personal point of view, I like a heist film, but as Nolan himself has said, the thing about heist films is a lot of it is the mechanics of the heist. So for example, if we take one of, I think, the best heist films ever is The Sting. It's an incredibly intricate story in terms of how they kind of pull it off, but there's a huge amount of exposition in how they set up The Sting. You look at The Italian Job, the same thing. You quite often have a couple of elements that the audience don't know about, so at the last second, somebody that you thought was bad was good. If you look at, what was the Soderbergh film with Thing 011, Thing 012, Thing 013? What was that?
Ocean's 11.
Thank you. So in that, you had that classic heist thing where, you know, it's very complicated, a lot of machinations, but as it's playing out, the audience isn't in on one or two of the key jokes. And so at the end, you get the ta-da, we kind of pulled the rug from out you, but, you know, you thought he was bad, but he was good, and we'd been sitting out up all the time. So to take a genre like that and turn it on its head with such a kind of intellectual bent, I thought was spectacularly good. Now, you commented on the snow scene. Nolan also quite unashamedly loved kind of the Bond thing and tried to play those things up in the film. And I think they worked, but you didn't like the snow stuff?
I mean, it's not that I didn't like it. I got it from the aspect of, you know, it's another sort of, you know, level of security in the dream in terms of he would have the snow fortress that makes it, you know, even more impenetrable. It's not that I didn't like it per se. It just sort of stuck out to me. And maybe if he's going for the Bond thing, then he succeeded, and then it's fine then. You know what I mean?
I mean,
it felt like the studio was like, we're going to need some action stuff, and we gave you 160 mil, so I think
it felt a little bit like a classic set piece, you know, in that respect.
I guess from my point of view, it was incredibly important that you could keep track of which layer they were on, because
exactly,
you had multiple characters in multiple layers of a recursive setup, and you needed them to be very distinctive. If you were cutting back to the snow scene and it was in Paris and you were, hang on, which one is that? Are they? Is this level two or level three? It could have been a complete mess. So if
It wasn't the snow per se. I didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry. It was just the way that it was with the skiing and the fight. And it's the Bond aspect that sort of stuck out from the rest of the film. But if that was his intention, then he nailed it.
Yeah. I think for me, there's that concept of in real life, if somebody imagines themselves in a dream, they imagine themselves in a popular culture thing. Like if – I remember somebody – giving a paper on this, and I was saying, if you imagine yourself in Happy Days, you don't imagine yourself as the Fonz. You imagine yourself as somebody that interacts with those characters in that world, and so getting these worlds to be quite distinctive and quite sort of vastly different, it just worked for me. I mean, I unashamedly adored this film, so I'm going to be very defensive of it.
No, I love the movie. I'm not saying that I didn't like the movie. I'm just saying, if we're being critical, that was the only something that stuck out
I mean,
to me as we're watching. Mm-hmm. But overall, most likely best film of the summer, possibly of the year, you know, in terms of overall everything.
I'm not trying to talk you around to a different point of view. I'm just...
No, I know.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is Memento is one of my all-time favorite films. Even conceptualizing that film, I think, is a feat of awesome filmmaking, yet alone the performances in it and the construction of it. And I do, being a kind of a guy from a technical background, I applaud any film that has a complex technical structure that can still play it out in a way that a non-technical person can follow, a very intricate plot with very unusual concepts, and it makes sense. And it didn't feel like there was a huge cheat, like, and then ... they escaped. And you wait a second, back up. What do you mean they just escaped? You know, so there was no big, we got ourselves into a corner, so we're just going to pretend it was all a dream and step out of it kind of ness. So this film felt like it had been 8 years in the writing.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was all, I mean, clearly from reading all the materials and doing research for the show, I mean, Nolan had it. At least, even though it changed in their collaborative process, he had it, you know, a tight structure.
Matt, the point that, before we get into the visual effects, that I thought was a nice touch is the kind of subtle plays they did, which have led many people to claim the entire film is a film about filmmaking. And I'll give you one example, which is the key music for the kick that kicks them back from kick one, kick two, and kick four, whatever it is. Is in fact then slowed down as the theme tune of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Were there aspects like that in terms of like subtlety of filmmaking and just sort of art direction, self-referential things that you picked up when you were watching it? Or is that all of us going crazy in the on the blogosphere and finding stuff that isn't really intentional?
Well, I will say in watching the film, I don't know that I was really watching it and thinking of it on a really allegorical level like that, where I was thinking, you know, oh, he's building a system in the narrative and the system is about, you know, the process of filmmaking. I don't know that I was really cognizant of that as I was watching the film. I think I was really just trying to follow the narrative and piece together what was happening and sort out, you know, sort of the action that was taking place. But I think going back and, you know, looking at all the ancillary material that, you know, we're talking about earlier, and seeing all the things that people have said about the film, I think it makes it really exciting. It's sort of like an onion, you know. There's so many layers of the onion that you can sort of peel back and get in there and really start to look at and examine, you know, how the film was written, how the film has been shot, and start to piece together, you know, different proxies for the characters in the film on a film set. You know, there was that one thing I think we all passed around. It'd probably be in the show notes, but we passed around that one site where some guy had gone through and broken down the whole film, and you know, had to. I don't know that I totally agree with that assessment 100%. But in your interview that you did with Paul Franklin too from Double Negative, I thought he seemed to suggest that that wasn't too far off the mark. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interview that's up on FX Guide. It's an audio podcast I did with the visual effects supervisor, who, by the way, Paul Franklin is a very good visual effects supervisor, and when we get to the visual effects, I'm going to be as gushing about it as I am about the film. But yeah, Paul was discussing those aspects of the filmmaking process that absolutely, it seems, not accidental. But you know, if you have time to make a film and you have time to not rush a film and it's not a studio or, for that matter, superhero property, then why not sort of layer up stuff? It's
Well, I think too, you know, just as an artist, you know, I think, you know, we don't, I mean, I think we would all probably say, you know, a filmmaker is certainly an artist, but I think there are people who, and for years and years, it's always been thought of filmmaking and films in general, it's not necessarily an art form so much as a commercial product. And I think, you know, oftentimes that's the case. You know, if you look at something like, you know, Cats and Dogs 2, that's probably much more of a commercial venture. But then I think a film like this comes along and it has, you know, star power in terms of the actors in it, but also in terms of the filmmaker. And it definitely has a major studio budget. But I think it's also an art film. I mean, clearly, Christopher Nolan, as the progenitor of this, you know, as the auteur, he is really making something that is extraordinarily creative on multiple levels. And I think, you know, it's really exciting to see a film like this come out and have the kind of box office success that it's had as well. And I think it really speaks volumes to the fact that I think there really is a market for this kind of filmmaking. You know, I think audiences in general are excited to see something unique, something original.
Well, I think audiences are so used to being talked down to for so long in a lot of movies and a lot of visual effects movies, you know, honestly, not from a visual effects standpoint, but oftentimes the visual effects are left as sort of, you know, icing on a cake. And right. To a story that doesn't really work, or isn't that good, or a film that isn't that good, and they just go to eat the popcorn and get out of the house. And then I think you get a movie like this where the audience gets engaged and feels respected by the filmmakers, and is brought into the process, so to speak.
And they even still especially, get their popcorn.
Right, exactly. And that popcorn becomes the icing.
Sure. So Jace, just tell us, for those that and I haven't read, how the film was made in terms of like what format it was shot on, and just a little bit about the basics of the film from a, you know, obviously starting with the fact it was actually shot on film.
Yeah, shot on mostly anamorphic.
Yep.
C&E series lenses, some Phantom, photosonics, some Arri 435. 65 millimeter, right? 70 millimeter and regular film, you know, 35.
And this was a film that that tried to do a lot in camera. So let's move to our visual effects. And there are a few big sequences that I think obviously, you know, scream out. But before we get into those specifics, Jason, do you have any critique of the visual effects just as a sort of believability kind of thing?
I liked every pixel of the visual effects. The only one, and after listening to the podcast that you did, that stuck out to me was when Leo and Cobb and Ariadne walk across the hinge of the floor in Paris. Mm-hmm. That felt overly digital to me. And after listening to the podcast and seeing online that it was they were walking on an actual gimbal that moved and everything, for whatever reason, that's the only shot where I was like, oh, that's weird. And it just sort of, you know, again, being critical. Other than that, everything worked for me perfectly. It was pristine work.
Yeah, I think it was good. Matt, what about you?
I liked almost all of the work in the film. There's two things that stuck out to me. There was one comp that I had some trouble with, and it was the comp where Ellen Page's character towards the end of the film, when she dives off the building, and we see, I think, a shot of her falling, looking down. And that comp to me, I've only seen the film once, but as I was watching that, I remember thinking like, ooh, you know, like that was one that jumped out where I thought it just didn't look up to snuff with some of the other stuff in the film. And the only other thing that isn't a digital effect, but that was a practical effect, and I think it's a there was just something about it that felt it didn't quite work for me, was the freight train on the street. And I'm not sure why that was the case. I read about that later, and Guy Dias, they talked about, and I think it was in the ASC article, and they talked about Guy Dias, who I worked with him when he was a visual effects art director at ILM, and he's a great guy, but they talked about him dressing a tractor trailer to basically look like a freight train. The train itself looked great, but the something just conceptually about that, like all of a sudden there's a freight train on a street where there's no tracks, and it was a practical effect, and you know, I guess it worked in the scene visually, but just conceptually there was something about it that felt odd to me. I don't know.
Really, I thought it was a brilliant idea to actually dress a truck as a train and drive the darn thing down the street. I thought that was just sheer genius.
And again, I think because they shoot because Wally Pfister and Nolan go for such a realistic style, the only thing that tells you they're in a dream at times is just them telling you you're in a dream. So I think, you know, not seeing tracks or not doing your mind, your brain is immediately like, oh, that stands out. There's no tracks. But in reality, it's a dream. So really, they have license to do anything.
Well, that's true. And I guess I think that's one of the things that's interesting about this film. And I think it's one of the things that's challenging about this film, too, is that it is all in a dream. And I know that this is something that was intentional. They wanted to keep things grounded in a certain kind of visual reality, whereas I guess the fact that it was in a dream, I almost had an expectation at times for it to go into a more supernatural kind of reality. And I think it's, you know, it's an interesting and not a bad choice that they made. I mean,
I think it's a really good choice in the sense that if you allow that anything could happen and there's no risk, then there's no peril, then I don't care about what happens to the characters. I've gone on about this quite a few times in podcasts, that you need to have an emotional concern for the characters that something actually will go wrong, not that, as happened in The Matrix 2, that he suddenly becomes Superman and he can do anything, and so why should I care because he's just going to fly away. And even if he doesn't fly away, he won't get hurt anyway because they can run anything into him you like and he's, you know, going to be okay. Whereas in this, they kept it grounded so that there was peril. You actually were concerned about people, even though they had to do some exposition to try and explain why this dream was threatening. And they had a couple of, I think, sort of knots there about, well, can't I just kill myself? Oh, no, this is different to normal. This time if you kill yourself, it would be bad, but normally it wouldn't kill yourself, it would be good, but let's keep moving on with the plot. Wally Pfister is, well, let's back up one section and say, in Batman in Dark Knight, when they flip the semi on the streets of Chicago, that has to be one of the most courageous decisions to do in camera in years, and validates the approach that Nolan and Pfister have done in terms of trying to do stuff practically. It's to take nothing away from the visual contribution of Dienegg, which is like some 600 shots, because in both cases, in Dark Knight and in this film, you couldn't have done these films without superb visual effects. It's just nice that they're working in harmony. And quite frankly, I don't think it should be a competition, I'm sure you guys agree, between digital and not, because in this day and age, we know we can do whatever. We just want to try and get the most impactful stuff happening. What I hadn't realized until I was doing some research for the film is that Wally Pfister actually has stopped working with any other directors. In fact, the last director he worked with was on Slow Burn, which was before the 2003 Batman Begins. He even turned down several Harry Potter films. So, you know, this is a collaborative partnership. And for that matter, if you look at Paul Franklin, he's been on the last three Nolan films with the two Batmans on this one. This is like a team that knows itself well. And it's interesting, as a kind of an insight in that, if you watch some of the publicity photos that have been filtering out from the film, you'll quite often notice the three of them, including Paul, on set or standing around discussing stuff. And I think that that they've reached a point of, they've got enough money to do what they need to do, they've got enough confidence to do it any way that they want, and no one's trying to prove anything. And so it's a really validated kind of position, because let's face it, the Paris flipping, you know, like the folding over of Paris is mm-hmm. just Dean Egg at its best. And I think the some of the stuff that they did, you know, practically, I love the use of miniatures that they went with for the ice fortress blowing up. I love that that wasn't all just digital. That, you know, it's like you've got this really good balance from a bunch of people that, that A, get it, and B, are not in a in a crunch to do it. It feels to me like a film that at no point its visual effects were kind of out of control or bumping the edge of what they could have done, and maybe if they'd done it again, they'd do it differently. It just felt like, well, professional, really.
Well, with the dream framing, you could easily have slipped into like a What Dreams May Come or some, mm-hmm. you know, wacky stuff. And the fact that they kept it in very tight, realistic, with just ever so slight rule changes per level or per, you know, section, I think made it feel even more than if you went over the top with visual effects.
I mean, there were references. Just references that Nolan has made about films that influence him in making this. They include Vertigo with Jimmy Stewart, especially in the way that you kind of trust Jimmy Stewart's character at the very beginning, as you do with Leonardo DiCaprio's. But then, as you go further along, you realize they aren't quite as in control as they appear. But also, The Wall and Blade Runner. And I just feel like this level of confidence and execution is just superb, given that I liked What Dreams May Come, but it's a very different place to go where anything's possible. And you kind of...
Oh, yeah, I wasn't saying that qualitatively. I was just saying from a look and an effect standpoint.
I couldn't agree more. Like, it's a really different place you end up once you start saying, I can break any rules. You know, What Dreams May Come, his daughter comes back as the airline hostess that the father's character had admired. And so, you know, even the notion of people appearing as other people and stuff, which of course, again, you could easily do in a dream, that people just start reappearing as different people and you can't kill somebody because they just pop up as somebody else, all that kind of stuff. It just becomes so kind of like, yeah, you can do anything. Yeah, shut up. Whereas this, because the reason I'm saying this is because I think it's very important to get at the visual effects from this idea of the visual authenticity that they wanted to provide in a world where everything was meant to be grounded, although everything was dreams. Like, it was paramount to the way the film was constructed that it didn't look like it was digital effects.
I was going to say, you know, the two along those same lines. I mean, you're talking about the way in which the visual effects and the in camera and everything sort of functioning together in a really seamless way, and the fact that these guys have built a really successful team together. I think, you know, the big sort of elephant in the room, I think the best stuff in the film that I just couldn't get enough of it was the I can't remember what level it is exactly, but where they're in the hallway, the hotel mm-hmm. set, and the rotating set, and the construction of that set, that there's a great sort of map of the set and the lighting setups in that issue of ASC and the ASC magazine, and they talk about sort of wanting to do something similar to the centrifuge set that was built for, you know, with all the self-enclosed lighting that was built for 2001. And I think, you know, they took that notion to another level, I think, with the sets that they built for that particular sequence. And the wire work is just phenomenal. I mean, in terms of where they chose to put the camera, how they dealt with the harnesses, and in your interview with Paul Franklin, he was talking about how even the costumers really got into it in terms of, you know, stiffening the shoelaces and things like that. And that attention to detail and that level of execution from both a practical and a digital level, I mean, it's something that I think we don't see that very often done to that extent, that well.
Matt, can you elaborate a bit further for those that haven't know just exactly how they did that, like the orientation you were alluding to there in terms of how it was shot?
Well, my understanding, and you can jump in if you have a better understanding of this, but my understanding is that they built that hallway set, and they had it essentially standing up vertically, if I'm not mistaken, and the camera was at the bottom looking up, or they had multiple mm-hmm. cameras in the scene, and the actors were from what I understand, coming when they're floating through the space. The I can't remember the name of that actor now, but the guy that's in the 500 Days of Summer,
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Right, and but he's hanging from a wire rig, and he's coming toward camera, or if he's going away from camera, he's hanging down essentially like a pendulum.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of tricks, but yes, that's a central one, and I think that's a brilliant move both from a technical point of view, because of course the wires tend to go behind them, and thus they're easier to remove, and then secondly because you tend to get a much more unusual motion, because we orientate ourselves to the floor of the thing, and if we don't orientate ourselves to the floor of it, we certainly orientate ourselves to it rotating around the axis of the hall. You don't tend to think that you're looking up because you're just so used to looking down a corridor. And yes, and so when he bounces off the walls, he's just, as you say, it's like a pendulum swinging left to right. It looks like he's doing weightlessness. And of course, it's pretty easy to go up and down the hall by just raising or lowering his wires. And I think that's like Cinefex visual effects. You read it as a kid and went, oh my God, that is so clever. You know, that was
Have you seen that Piers Bosney book on the making of 2001? I think that's the author's name. And there's a great chapter in there just about building that centrifuge set and about how it would get really hot. And they had to have all these cables on like big spindles so they could unwind and rewind cables to keep everything, you know, from coming unplugged in essence. And so they could have the actors, you know, sort of walking in circles around that set piece. And in the ASC article, they even talk about, I keep saying ASC, but the American Cinematographer magazine article, they even talk about how they developed a brush metal system so that they could continuously have electricity without having all these cables. And they basically, I feel like they basically redid, you know, a Kubrick-like set piece, but they did it, you know, with modern techniques and modern technological means. And I just feel like it's some of the most interesting visual effects work that I've seen in, you know, a decade or more. I mean, it just blew my mind. It was so great.
Yeah, it really feels like with this film, Nolan's moved himself into the pantheon of Hitchcock and Kubrick as both technical filmmakers, but also filmmakers of consequence.
I was going to say in those hallway scenes, they also built track into the floor in the carpet. And since the carpet has those vertical lines, they could hide the track in there. And I think it had, I think they did motion control because they would program the camera to be at certain spots at certain times. And then they had a second camera on a technocrane that they just stuck in the tube as they needed it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to just, and I'm not picking on you, Jason, but I'm going to just point out that in a lot of the press, they try and go on about how it was all done for real. And also they go on about how, you know, practical, and obviously a huge component was, but I'm willing to bet all the money in my pocket that there's some artist listening to this at DNEG who said, what? I had to paint out that bloody track for weeks. And it wasn't just hidden. Yeah, sure. It sounds like you could hide it in the bloody floor.
In the production still, and of course it can be Photoshopped, and the way they described it, they said they tried to hide it.
And I'm sure that's the case. I'm just a little sensitive because some of the press around this film has been all about how they were trying to do it in camera without visual effects. And I can just imagine this poor artist because if you listen to, you guys mentioned that podcast I did with Paul Franklin, but he was saying that the artists that worked on the wire removal section of the Inception scenes were pretty much junior members of the DNEG team that joined up, and they had the expectation that other senior members would be coming on, but because of scheduling reasons, this team, basically a baptism of fire, ended up doing a lot of the work. And it's one of the things that Paul's really, really proud of, is how well this team performed. And so for those people that are probably also listening to this podcast thinking, you know, yeah, how much bloody work did I do? I just don't want to imply that for a second we imagine that there wasn't some of the most heinous, complicated rig removal to do.
Hey, and you know, absolutely, how cool is that? How cool is that too, right? I mean, they're not junior artists anymore. I mean,
stick it on your reel and put the postage stamp on and say thanks. Yeah.
Well, because in that, you have to keep referencing that podcast because it's so detailed, but he said, I mean, there's huge gaping holes in the the set where they had to put the wires through and other things. There's tons and tons of paint and roto in there.
It's just that, don't you feel like on this show, you're amongst friends, and if you're a visual effects artist, we're not going to pretend for a second that special effects nailed it all. Because I think special effects did an enormous job, especially in the scene. But I'd hate for anyone to think that, you know, just like of anyone, any podcast, of any group that should be able to give a nod to the fact that even the best special effects would have worked. Because, like, let's face it, in the film, what was the one where the drug one, Trainspotting, they had a baby on a rig on a roof and they did the same kind of thing, the track, and it was so obvious that the track was there. I mean, it was like it was you're watching a Disneyland kind of animatronic ride. It was just hopeless because they didn't have visual effects to take out the track lay. And I guess I'm just saying that like as much as I think the special effects team are getting full credit for the work they did, I know just and can guess that the guys that did the wire removal, especially on this sequence, are going to get lost because everyone's so impressed with turning a set on its end. But I think both deserve credit. I think one other point should be made is that the actors that were meant to be the bodies that were wrapped up in the cable, for the stunt people to do that, a lot of them had to be suspended upside down for extended periods of time because by turning the set on its end, if you were one of the bodies that had its head down rather than head up, if you can think of that conceptually, because now the whole set is turned on its end, then you're hanging upside down for extended periods of time, which is why it wasn't the actors that were doing that work. And it's like, can you imagine that? Like, you've got a whole lot of cameras ready to roll. You've got to get people all set up, hair and makeup, everything's got to be perfect. Then you've got to suspend them upside down in rigs in a wireless setup. They can't move.
They're supposed to be dead or asleep, whatever.
And then you've got to get in place. Then you've got to get the performances from any other actors that are actually moving. You gotta make sure the lighting's right, that focus is right, and everything else. And you couldn't possibly have those people upside down for very long before you'd have to, you know, level them out, although they'd blooded rush to their head and they'd pass out. And you'd have to have some way of monitoring that they're okay. And you don't want somebody that suddenly passes out, you don't notice that they're playing dead because, oh my God, they're actually dead. Like, just think about the logistics of actually filming that scene. Every department, as I think Paul said in that thing, which is just kicking it.
And then, to your comment again about visual effects, then they went in and replaced the heads of, I think, Ken Watanabe and Tom Hardy, right?
Yeah, just superb. So now, look, that is a scene that is, I guess, well, is that the iconic scene of Inception? I guess it is. It's the one that we.
I think it's that and the folding. Iconic scenes.
The fact that you have two is pretty impressive. So let's discuss Paris Folding, because that is, again, a really good mix of practical and live action, because while the folding is obviously completely done with digital manipulation of buildings in a way that DNEG seems to do better than almost anyone else in the world, there is, of course, also the high-speed explosions shot with the photosonics cameras at about 150 frames a second. And I found those explosions worked sensationally well, as did the folding. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it all worked really good. I really enjoyed, and I thought the visual of the first part of the fold, where it really starts to come up, and we're seeing all the hard shadows moving across the environment, and I thought that stuff was just really strong. The explosions of the particles.
Yeah, so they're in the cafe, and things just start, you know, bursting off around them.
I'm a huge fan of any and all effects animation when it's done well. I so many of my closest friends are FX TDs at different companies, and I think that's a special skill set. People who do that and who do it really well, and that stuff I thought was just great. It just looked really cool. It was really an unusual opportunity to get to, you know, basically explode, you know, fruit and papers.
Though a bunch of that was shot literally at 1,500 frames a second. Like, a bunch of that stuff is...
Really? So a lot of that's actual practical?
Oh, yeah.
I thought a lot of that was digital.
It's digitally enhanced. Yeah, well, there you go. It's digitally enhanced. And, like, by the way, I'm totally with you, right? Effects TDs have my undying respect. I think effects TDs are some of the most interesting areas of visual effects, full stop right now. But yeah, no. When Paige starts experimenting with the physical world, and DiCaprio's kind of showing off with the stuff happening. Those
so you can see I didn't read all the materials.
No, that's fine. I mean, there is air cannons and there's... I have to read this stuff. It's my job. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's air cannons and high-speed effects.
I thought the stuff when it finally folded all the way over and you were looking sort of up at the city, it was a really neat... conceptually, it was really cool. And, it looked fine and stuff, but it was one of those things where, it went... And I'm kind of contradicting myself here, but it was one of those things where it went outside of the real into the surreal in a way that, like... it's hard to conceptualize that as a real thing in your head.
And but so it didn't look comical.
It didn't look funny. No, it didn't. No. It didn't look funny, and it didn't look wrong. It just didn't look. It's so unbelievable that it's. It's hard to. I mean, it's hard to wrap your head around it, right? Like it just looks.
I agree. When I first saw the first trailer for Inception, and I didn't realize anything about the film. I didn't know it was Nolan. I didn't know anything about it. I just saw this bit of a clip. I was like, uh-oh, is this going to be another effects, porn film where it's just, effects for effects' sake? And it's all going to be like one of those, there's some of those video games where they come up with just really bizarre imagery, but there is no plot in the story. And that this would be the one big thing that was the climax of the film, that they were basically giving you the, this is what we spent all our money on, so we're going to put it in the trailer thing. And in reality, it wasn't that way. I feel like this was...
It was almost incidental, really, to the story. It was like about sort of setting up the things that you maybe can do in that world. And the stuff with the mirrors, too, I thought was really something.
Mike, it's really funny that your impression of the trailer and that effect is the exact opposite of mine, because I knew it was a Nolan movie. And I saw that and I was like, I want to see this movie. Just from the folding scene, I was like, I'm seeing this movie. I don't care. It's going to be awesome. And I didn't get the impression that that was, for lack of a better term, a hinging effect in the film. I just felt like okay, he's telling you, get ready because we're going to do some awesome shit and just sit back. And actually, the what you were saying, Matt, the total fold, I actually really liked right out of the gate because I wasn't expecting it. Because was so used to what was happening in the trailer of just seeing it going like, rawr, I figured they would just get out of it on the fold, and to have it come up and then go all the way over and lock with like a nice big effect and, be solid and then let you stand there and look at it. Like, it screams confidence.
Hey, how did you guys see the film? What was the presentation environment?
I just saw a digital projection.
Matt?
Yes, so did I. A DLP, yeah.
I saw the IMAX projection. And if you can, once I found out this was a Nolan film, and once I actually saw the whole trailer and even got the name of the film, I was like, oh, okay, I'm not missing this. And then from then on, there was no doubt in my mind that I was going to see this in IMAX, having seen Dark Knight in IMAX and finding it to be one of the best cinema experiences I'd ever had. I want them to re-release Memento in IMAX. But anyway... And it stood up so well on a giant screen. And we had, optimum seating up the back, good field of view. It was a huge print. We got in and within days. This is in Los Angeles of it being released. Like it was a day or two out. So it was good print. Everything was perfect. And I really tried studying that and the cars and everything about it. And it just held up extraordinarily well. The level of detail and Dineg's ability to do these buildings and to do the rooms inside the buildings, because probably people who don't know, just I guess I'm jumping ahead slightly, but the trick about making a building look good isn't they're getting the facade right. That's what you can buy on a, sort of a library thing. What makes these rooms sell is that if you ever get any hint of inside the room, the curtains are set back from the, and then there's a whole room beyond that that is in perspective that you see the floor where you would have seen the wall as it turns, and that's what made it work in Dark Knight. It's what made it work in Inception. But that is an astonishing level of detail. And it wasn't like they just trotted out the Chicago buildings that they'd already had on file or something, because it was Parisian and distinctly Parisian, I thought.
You're building all those boxes. Yeah. Did they, did Dineg finish everything at just standard 2K or?
Oh, good question. I think they did it higher res than that, but I can't tell you that for sure. I should know that.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to note, just because having, you know, that you've seen it in IMAX. I have to say too, and this is going to sound snarky, but I can't help it, I'm so glad that this movie is in 2D.
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to give points to Stu Mashewitz, who I think said Inception proves that a 2D film can still be just as immersive. And I don't know that it would have benefited at all from being 3D. That being said, I saw 8 minutes of Tron Legacy.
Oh, I saw that too. Cigarette. I was in there. Yep.
Yeah, and because it was good 3D and the way that Avatar was good 3D, I enjoyed it. And mm-hmm. so I'm not saying that I would have disliked this film if it had been three-dimensional. I think Nolan would have provided the same level of discipline in terms of having it like the screen as a window, so you're looking through to it rather than, you know, sort of effects. So had it been shot three-dimensional and everything else, I think that that would be good. But if you were looking at the next Batman film, I would much prefer them to shoot that entirely in IMAX than shoot it entirely stereoscopically. And I imagine the cameras would be about the same size between a double, you know, camera rig and an IMAX camera. I'd love them to shoot that sucker on film, IMAX.
I think that was Nolan's main reason to the studio why he didn't want to shoot 3D is because he wanted to do it all handheld. This movie has a lot of handheld work in it, and it's very hard to do, especially with film cameras, to do handheld 3D.
Though ironically, absolutely, but ironically, it's also got some digital in there, because when you start shooting high speed,
right,
it's a hell of a lot easier to shoot high speed digital at the moment than it is to shoot high speed film.
Go on. I was just going to ask, do you know, the other thing I had a note of that was something that I really liked a lot in the film that I thought really worked well was the, you know, all the kick stuff and the van and the interior shots of the van in slow motion. I thought was really, there was something about all that footage that I just really loved watching. And was that all, was that Phantom stuff, or was that some other high speed?
There's a couple of ways that they did the I've actually been trying to get an interview with the company that provided all the high speed cameras that were both digital and film, and I'm pretty sure, so I'm going to stick my neck out here and say I'm pretty sure this is how it worked. There was the Phantom HD stuff, there was also some film stuff, but the film stuff was really extraordinary, because for the film to go through the gate and be able to shoot at the high speed, you can't actually stop the film in the gate, expose it, and then pull down the next piece of film, as we all know how a film camera works. A film cinema camera is no different to an old film stills camera in that, you know, you would wind it on a frame, take a shot, wind it on. Obviously, mm-hmm. normally in a feature film camera, it's running and clicking through pretty quickly. The way that the super high-speed film cameras work is the film continually moves through the film plane and a mirror rotates, and that mirror literally aims the picture at the moving film as it's going by, effectively sweeping the image onto the film, thus stopping the film from having to stop in the gate, which would actually rip the film apart. And the physics of the pull-down mechanism would cause the teeth at the side of the sprockets to actually get bent out of whack, making this some of the most complicated film cameras in existence. And in the past, these notoriously didn't work. They obviously did work here. So hopefully we can still follow up with those guys on those cameras. But the rig for the car, I think, well, Jason, you've probably seen the photos of that, have you? Like the car rig. I think there was a name that Nolan came up for it. I just can't remember what it was. It was something very funny, though.
It was Tunnel of...
Expense or something.
Expense, yeah, something like that. I mean, they basically did it the same way as they did the hallway. They mounted the van on an arm and put the camera in it, and then they could spin it, and it was surrounded by lights so that it would get shadows as it spun, so you would get, you know, feel like you were in daylight. And they also had it outside. I think they did a lot of effects shots outside to catch as much daylight as they could, even though that obviously they have to do studio lighting on top of that. But
so were those were they comping in a background in there, or was it all just using whatever?
Yeah,
was?
No, it's around green. It was on a green screen.
Yeah, those were nice comps too.
Oh yeah, I think the stuff in the car played really well, but it was an interesting mix of the fact that you so needed the car stuff to be in slow-mo to keep your head across what was going on. You know, like
it was amazing. Every time they cut, as the film progresses in that last hour, which my friend described, he was describing the movie to me before I saw it. He's like, just remember that about an hour and a half into the movie, they set up what they're going to do, and then it's basically an hour-long action sequence. and because he told me that once they started into the first dream layer, that's what I was waiting for. But when they, as that hour-long action sequence progresses and you're getting towards the end of it, and they cut to just like a quick shot of the van basically hanging, moving super slow about 20 feet over the water. I mean, that's all you need to see. And that tells you everything about how dire the circumstances
are. But interestingly, from a filmmaking point of view, if you think about it, when you're jumping between level of limbo world and level above, which is the ski stuff, and even a level above that to the lift, you don't require the lift level or the ski level to be in slow-mo. You just require the van level to be in slow-mo to remind yourself that everything's working at a different time speed. Does that make sense?
Right, but they also gave you the spinning aspect of the hotel level to give you that visual reference, because the van is spinning, so that has to be spinning.
So the ski level? I'm not complaining.
Ski level was white.
Okay, but I'm just saying, like, you didn't. So the audience gets it. You just need one reminder of the time
thing. No, absolutely. I wasn't contradicting you.
But also the skiing. Why wasn't that revolving if the hotel was revolving? Sorry.
Yes, sir. You're correct.
I'm just saying.
flying snow.
Yeah, but I don't care. I'm not saying it bugged me in the film, but it's like interesting. Like, the audience only needs so much kind of cue to keep them and getting those.
Although I just realized, because they're sleeping and still, and the set is rotating around them in the hotel, the snow wouldn't actually be rotating.
Okay.
if you want to work it out.
Wasn't Tom Berenger good? Anyway, sorry. Okay.
I didn't even realize that was him till the credits.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't Tom either. Berenger.
Yeah. I'll even forgive him for his appearance on Cheers. Okay, so let's discuss a couple of the other sequences, and the big one is Limboland, and that whole environment of the constructed, layer four of.
Yes.
So, what did you think? Because unlike what we've just described, this was a much more digitally produced environment, especially the seascape with the glacial collapse of Limboland into the subconscious or ocean of. Subconscious. Do we like it?
Yeah, very much. Although I immediately recognize it as Los Angeles for a lot of the downtown city stuff, which didn't take me out of it. It was just funny. I was like, oh, that's cool, LA. But I thought all those effects were so perfectly done from a creative standpoint, much less the execution.
Yeah, I would say the same. I mean, I just think the design aesthetic that was utilized in sort of that conceit that this was the world that they built, you know, and it was their perfect world or whatever, you know. I mean, it kind of looked like sort of a downer perfect world. I don't know if my perfect world would have tons of skyscrapers in it. But, you know, it was I thought it looked great. I mean, the lighting in that environment looked really nice and stuff. And it was really clean. And again, you know. The collapse of the buildings, you know, the simulations in there. I thought all that stuff, unless those were miniatures, I don't actually.
No, they weren't.
I don't
want to
make
Sims.
That mistake again. But
no, that was Sims. The only miniature was the collapse of the snow fortress was a miniature. The the other stuff was just extremely good Sims work.
Yeah, I thought the design aesthetic of the limbo. Sorry, Matt. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying. Yeah, I thought that stuff was really good. That the I'm just repeating what Mike said.
I was just going to say, I thought the design aesthetic of the limbo outside of the crumbling cliff face aspect internally, with those rows and rows of slightly staggered, almost Kubrickian monolith, you know, type skyscrapers, really reflected the fact that they were there for about 50 years. Because you could only imagine that how bored you would probably get with, yeah, like, I can create anything. You would just be like, fine, row of skyscrapers, you know, at varying sizes. Like, it immediately conveyed time.
Yeah, I liked the in Limbo Land. There was the old house that was reminiscent or directly linked to the toy house, what is it called? Toy
dollhouse.
Dollhouse. Yeah. Thank you. I liked the mixing up of the, and also it was a place of, in some respects, solitude. It wasn't a populated area. That's why I kind of bought the city thing, because who hasn't been in the city like on a Sunday when there's just no one around, it seems? And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it didn't feel like it's Gotham City, and it didn't feel, sorry, go on.
Downtown LA, midweek.
Yeah.
It's like that every day, it seems like, down there.
Let's just have a bit of a shout out to Ian Hunter and the guys over at New Deal for the destruction of the fortress, because the Snow Fortress was good old-fashioned, hardcore, bloody great miniatures destruction, of which the type that this show tends to applaud. I mean, that was totally sold to me. It didn't feel like a miniature. It didn't feel... it was...
Oh, I didn't feel like a miniature to me at all. I was like, wow, where'd they find that building? That's an awesome building.
Yeah. I think New Deal, there's probably two places that you would go to. Obviously, Kerner Optical and New Deal are those two. And in both cases, they tend to deliver, and they deliver very effectively. Obviously, New Deal's done lots of great stuff with Scorsese and stuff, and there's a huge lineage with Kerner.
Where is New Deal? I'm not familiar with them.
New Deal, I've been there. It's in LA. I say that. Huh. I'm pretty sure I've been there. I have been there. I just can't remember if it's in LA or not.
Yeah.
In fact, I was there before Shutter Island was made, and they had the props that were going to Shutter Island. So they had like these huge amounts of bodies with tarps over them. But the reason that one of the reasons we were so thrilled to talk to those guys when we did is that was after they'd done the superb miniature work on Dark Knight with the Batmobile hitting the garbage truck. Do you remember that sequence?
Oh, yeah.
And that was a miniature setup that those guys did. And, yeah, they're just very, very good at what they do. But, again, I love the fact that New Deal have had a working relationship with Nolan and that they've continued that. I love loyalty, I guess. I love it when filmmakers are not just, yeah, I'll see you on the next job and then don't. So,
yeah, for sure.
It's a pretty big miniature. You've seen the photos. I've got some over at Aircake's Guide, but it's not small. I mean, it's, what, four stories high? It seems like,
it's bloody. See, bigature.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
I guess the only other company that's really been kicking it in terms of miniatures like that is Weta. I mean, their Lord of the Rings bigatures were pretty sensationally great. I liked that we didn't have a sort of radical fly-arounds on this set. It didn't. It was filmed with the aesthetic of someone that was filming a big thing. We didn't have any bird's-eye eagle views sort of swooping around the – not that I remember anyway. Did you?
Well, I think that's what sold it to me probably just subconsciously is that – it was like, okay, that's a massive building, and we're on a snowy slope, so the camera's going to go right here. It felt like
they're
real
on sticks or something.
Shot. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't like, let's put the camera wherever we want, because obviously we know that he's doing more realistic cinematography, but it feels like that's the main intent. Like, no matter what department's working on it, special effects, visual effects, camera department, they're always thinking about how they would do it for real, so that it meshes all together properly.
I mean, you need that size not only for the destruction stuff, but for the flames and the interaction stuff to really get that sense of weight in the concrete and especially that reinforced concrete. So it does have a sort of solidity to it combined with the scale of the flames. And if you click on any of the pictures in the FX Guide story, you get large pictures. We actually were provided with like 4K or kind of enormous pictures, far too big for us to post. And I can tell you that I haven't yet to find a frame or a detail in a frame that wouldn't have withstood. And these are stills, of course, where you can like zoom up and have a look at them and look in the windows, literally, of the detail inside where the, because they go in through those air vents and climb up the cleverly explained escape route with the air vents. But that, because they were filming it that way, you don't kind of get to have those aerial view shots as we see from the special effects shots, and it just holds up the level of detail inside the rooms for the explosions. you've got to at some level just be crying when you blow that sucker up. I mean, I know that's the job, but you'd be like, no, don't blow this one up. Let's just keep this one. I'll put it in my backyard. But yeah, four stories high at least, and great, great work. That being said, it's, I guess, a compliment to DNEG that you thought maybe some of the Limboland explosions were also miniatures, because, again, that they didn't look like one was one technique and one was another.
Mm-mm. No, yeah. I think it all, I mean, just visually, the entire film, I felt like everything really tied together really well.
So is there anything else that that we want to touch on in terms of visual effects? I mean, there must have been a lot of other work done in terms of painting stuff out and doing things, and there are some spectacular sequences outside VFX, just like the skiing photography I thought was very good. But there's anything else that I haven't touched on that you guys wanted to mention?
The only thing I was going to mention is just, you know, and now Jason's mentioned it too, but just all the connections, sort of the Kubrickian connections, I think are so neat. Even like when they finally get to open up the vault, and the Pete Postlethwaite character is in the hospital bed, and the set is so reminiscent, and I think intentionally so. It really felt like sort of an homage, you know, like it's very reminiscent to the set that the Dave Bowman pre-Starchild character winds up in, the sort of French Revival kind of set. And I thought all of that stuff, for me, just as like a total film geek, you know, someone who loves all that stuff, I really enjoyed all that stuff. It's not directly related to the effects per se, but just to the overall look and feel and design of the film. I mean, I really think this is a film for people who love filmmaking.
Completely agree. What did you think about the lighting? It was like heavy use of diffused lighting sources and stuff, with the exception of the Paris stuff, which had the stronger directional exterior lighting. What did we think? Were you conscious of that, or did you just feel like it flowed?
I personally wasn't conscious of it, but
I wasn't conscious of any. It felt like very natural lighting. Like there was no. I was in the ASC article with Wally Pfister. He said, "I don't want anyone to see or feel like it's lit. I just want it to feel natural." I guess he comes from a documentarian background, and he just wants it to feel appropriate for the scene. And again, because of the way that they're working and doing all their color timing right from the work print.
That brings us to our last big point, which is what I wanted to discuss. The fact that this is a film that, to my complete surprise, went down a non-DI, very much almost photochemical path, right to the point of actually having a Steinbeck editing bench and Edge timecode machines in the edit bays with the Avids. Is that indulgence? Is that kind of...
I would say no. I mean, I think that's actually really interesting. And I mean, this might sound kind of pompous, but I mean, I actually think that, you know, if when it's all said and done, if this film is on another level, if it's a sort of almost a semi-autobiographical film about the nature of Christopher Nolan as filmmaker, I think, you know, as an artist, you know, if you accept that one of the things that I think all artists make systems, right? I think that's what artists do. And if you can kind of go that down that path, and you can accept that thinking in those terms about the total, being a total artist and working in a specific fashion, I think for Christopher Nolan, making this film, which clearly was a personal, you know, passion, he worked on this film for, they said, the script for like 8 years or something. And I think, you know, to then go all the way down that path and to stick with kind of almost a more traditional sense of sort of the historical traditional filmmaking techniques, I think seems appropriate. It seems like he's incorporating a methodology of making.
This is a film that literally watched film dailies with sound every night. I don't know the last time I could have said that about a film.
Well, I think also the thing is they've given themselves their sort of working mantra of getting it in camera, lighting it to look the way they want it to look. So it kind of would be contrary for them to spend all that time to do that and then be like, well, we'll just and then we can also fix it in the DI. You know what I mean? Like they picked a workflow and an approach of how they were going to do it on set and kept that all the way through to the end, which includes the photochemical finish.
Okay,
and that also
Jason. Right? what yes. camera do you have? What stills camera do you have?
550D.
Okay, and when you get those photos back, do you put them into something like Aperture or Lightroom?
Yes, of course.
And do you tweak them? Because I freaking do.
Yeah, of course.
And would you really want to be shooting your stills and not having the benefit of the Aperture and Lightroom for sake of the principle of it? I mean, I'm just saying, I am stunned.
I own a Red camera much as you do. I enjoy having that opportunity to do those things in post. I'm saying they made the decision to do that and stuck with it all the way, which made them stick with a photochemical process, because Wally Pfister...
Okay, but I'm not criticizing them at this point. I'm actually saying respect, because I wouldn't want to film scenes this complicated and say, don't worry about it because I've nailed it. You know,
it's balls. It's huge balls.
It's balls out at a level I just can't even comprehend. Like getting the exposure right at 1,500 frames a second, but also just there's very subtle lighting. I mean, that final scene with the old aged, DiCaprio goes into.
Yeah,
that's really gorgeous. You're very yellow, but you know, you don't have, at photochemical stage, you can't control contrast, you can't crush the blacks, you can't, you know, raise DiCaprio's face out because you've exposed for the jacket and he's wearing darks and his face is like, it's all, you know.
I know, it's incredible.
It's hardcore. And
well, maybe you guys think that's crazy, but I mean, I just think when it's all said and done, I just feel like that's the art. That's the artist.
No, I don't think it's crazy. I don't think it's crazy at all. I'm saying I respect the.
I think it's crazy.
What works for this film?
I think it's.
I'm saying they made. It's not crazy because they can do it.
Well, it's not crazy. They can do it. Okay, I understand that, but I understand. Don't get me wrong. Total respect that they did it. The fact that they pulled it off is, and I in no way feel like the film is compromised because of it. But this is like saying, I'm not going to look at the script once I've learnt my lines. That's my point. My point is that deciding to rid yourself of the ability to have that extra level of control produces stunt work filmmaking at a level that I don't think the audience necessarily makes any discernible difference over. It's just making life really hard for yourself. And if you can pull it off, like a stage actor obviously doesn't halfway through the performance on stage got to pick up the script and read for the next, you know, bit and then go, yeah, put it down. Okay, now let's keep going with the stage play. In the same way that is makes me respect a stage actor, I totally respect the DOP for pulling this off. But it's really hard to imagine that why you'd want to do that.
But don't you think, though, that, I mean, isn't this how, like, films were made, you know, 15 years ago? Like, I mean, isn't this how everything was being made, in essence? I mean, there was no, we weren't DI and everything, and things weren't being shot digitally, you know, for cinematic release. I mean, it just feels kind of old school, doesn't it? I mean.
Yes, absolutely. Totally correct. And you could take that approach. You say, well, why is it so remarkable when they could do Lawrence of Arabia this way? But I would say that the benchmark of acceptable lighting, quality of exposure, color, etc., has been raised so far through the advent of these tools that you're now no longer comparing yourself with Lawrence of Arabia, though this film stacks up very well against it. You're comparing yourself to, you know, every other film, almost every other film that's been released this year, which has all those extra benefits. You are working with anamorphic lenses, which have their own peculiarities. I mean, right down to sort of weird flaring and odd things, especially when you go fully open on them. There's so much complexity. And we romantically remember, like I remember looking at, I don't know, on this show we were talking about Back to the Future. I thought the visual effects at the time were impeccable. Looking at it again, you know, you can see flames through his legs. I think that this film stands up against a film that has a massive DI budget, a huge amount of time, like months spent with some of the best colorists in the world, and yet it didn't have all of that. And we just remember films like from bygone eras as being beautifully color timed and perfectly matching, when in fact they probably weren't if you went back and looked at them again.
Oh, I was just going to say they're just putting all us young punks
to shame.
Our place, I guess, you know? Yeah.
Totally.
In the scene where they do the kick in the bathtub near the beginning, I'm looking for the actual description because it's pretty insane. He said he was on his anamorphics at 4.5, but because of the Oh, here you go. I have to read it because it's insane. He wanted the speed ramp. Nolan wanted the speed ramp going into the water. So they wanted to hit 1,000 frames per second using the Photosonics camera, but they had a 7-stop light loss. So the lenses he had, he could only go to 4.5 on them. So he said he was getting the equivalent of F90 on the edge light, measuring the light at 24 frames per second. So they had two Condors outside the window, two Arimax 18K PARs with spot reflectors that were less than 15 feet from DiCaprio, and they also had two 12K PARs hitting the ceiling just for fill. I mean, that's an insane amount of light.
I mean, literally, if those lights weren't professionally set up, then the ultraviolet alone had caused DiCaprio to be hospitalized. Because the... I'm serious. Like, it would literally give him...
Well done.
Yeah, it would... you would get horrendous burns from a sun, effectively like a suntan. I mean, the thing is, I'm not saying they didn't pull it off, and I'm not saying I don't respect them for doing it, but oh my God, they made life hard for themselves. And yet, you know, I love that they did. I just personally would be on set going, really? You sure we can't just... Okay, sure, no problem. I just think it, because it would be really easy. Okay, no, sure, fine, okay.
Read the interview with the editors.
Well, that would actually be a really interesting conversation. I mean, that would be an interesting dialogue to have and to hear, you know, sort of the justification for those choices. Like, I don't know that I've heard, you know, why? Like you're saying, like, why do that? Why?
I mean, I think that it's magnificent
to
have,
you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's magnificent to have filmed dailies. It's a luxury of time and of budget that very few directors are allowed. Nolan's earned the right to have whatever the hell he wants, and far be it from me to criticize, because he's a vastly better filmmaker than I'll ever be. But I'm just saying, like, I think that's great. And some of those decisions, totally obvious. I would love to be able to go to film dailies and watch them because you get such a sense of what's really going on the film and et cetera, et cetera. But they extended this to a Steinbeck, to, you know, not using DI, to, like, there's just, like, a bunch of things. Like, is anyone... I mean, you guys have
I would love to hear in the end that it was a total artistic choice about wanting to function within a set of systems and parameters, and even within a set of restraints, you know, to create a certain kind of dynamic. I would love to hear that was the story. That would be really cool if that were the fact, you know.
What I read in the article with the editor is that it seemed to the way he was saying it, that one of the main reasons is that Nolan loves the look of the work print, and it really bothers him to look at it any other way.
Okay, so that's I'm there, but
issue, that's his. No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying for Matt, who asked why, that right there is one of the reasons why he wants to stick with just with film.
Yeah, interesting.
If you had a normal film, like let's say he had made a more like a Memento, less a visual complex film as this, though Memento is pretty friggin' editorially complex, then maybe I could have said, well, okay, because, you know, you've like, you're not trying to do 18 other things, but this film is trying to do 18 other things and pull it all off without the benefit of, and that's, it's not just the gear, it's all of the friggin' staff that no longer do this anymore. I mean, I don't know anyone that, you know, like a edit assist that can grab a, you know, trim bin and use film edge coding stuff from, you know, the optical bench. And I mean, just running Steinbecks and all that kind of stuff, like they're in museums. I can't even think of one that's working in Sydney.
Well, they had assistants just calling out all over the world to find splice tape that wasn't bubbled from being old and edge code tape that wasn't crumbling. And like, just because it's just not, it's just
but
not
I guess,
made
you know, maybe I have like a skewed sense of time too. I don't know. I mean, it has been a long time since I was there. But when I first was working at ILM, they were still doing. I mean, everything was on film still, of course. And this was in like 93 to, you know, I guess around 97 when things started going more digitally. But you know, they still had tons of bins and they had film hanging up, and there were guys working, visual effects editors who had been there for years. There were guys in there who were working, you know, with film every day, and they were lining everything up, you know. And I mean, it wasn't that long ago. And some of these guys were training, you know, younger guys that were more my age. You know, they were training younger guys to be doing traditional film stuff as
well. But the opticals on Empire as great as they are, couldn't solve a bunch of technical problems because they just didn't have the tools, and they had to, you know, do verticals of windows of fighters 50% transparent because they had to try and remove edges and stuff. Like, there's a, like, my point is, and I'm going to let it go. Obviously, if they want to write a novel on a typewriter instead of a word processor, and it's a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, who am I to criticize? But I'm just thinking it's let's not romanticize how friggin' hard it was back then and how few.
Well, I like that. I like that you brought it up. I mean, I think it's fascinating. I didn't actually know that, and so it's really fascinating that you bring that up. I mean, I think it's really an interesting. I mean, I would love to hear more about it. You know, I'm sort of fascinated by it now. It's really fascinating.
I am as well. And also, does this move forward? Is this his, you know?
Yeah, we'll see, I guess, right?
Yeah, because, like, I mean, you know, let's shoot IMAX and shoot the whole thing instead of IMAX and then edit it all on film. I don't know. anyway, well, that's it for this week. It's been a superb pleasure talking about this film. Matt, where can people track you down, find out more? Follow you, stalk you?
Best place would be mattwallen.com, or I'm on Twitter at Matt Wallen.
And Jason?
The Twitter's Jason Diamond, one word. And I have my one comment that I always have to make when I say my name, is that I found it really fascinating that he cast Marion Cotillard as his wife, Cobb's wife, and that the main theme of the whole movie was Edith Piaf, and she played Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose.
Okay, he said that was a coincidence.
No, I hadn't even seen anything about it, period. I just realized it while I was watching the movie. I didn't even know she was in the movie I didn't see her in the trailer. So that's it. You know, I like that it's a coincidence, but it's still interesting.
Coincidences like that happen all the time when you
I'm sure.
When you start cooking in the kitchen with so many different ingredients, you know?
Yeah.
Well, Jason, as I think Arthur says to Cobb in the film, you should walk away from this man.
Yes.
And look, we have a great team behind the scenes that work to put this show together each week. Jason?
Yeah, we really want to thank our producers, Todd Schulten and Matt Graham. They do amazing work through the whole process.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to hook up. Obviously, Matt was traveling with me when we just got back from shooting in Yellowstone for a week, which, oh, by the way, was just insanely great, but I don't want to go into a rat hole on that. And then we went to SIGGRAPH for a week, which was also really cool. But Todd came over for SIGGRAPH, so we got to hang out, and always a pleasure. Todd is a hell of a nice guy. Obviously, I get to spend a lot of time with Matt, and he probably gets sick of seeing me, but I hadn't spent that kind of time with Todd before, and they're both great guys, and we really appreciate their contribution. And we really appreciate you guys for supporting the show and listening to us and downloading us and sending us notes and stuff. And there's a lot of activity. People follow this show on Twitter. It's the VFX show. They also, of course, go and see it on the FX Guide site. But I get a lot of feedback when I do these trips, like I'm at SIGGRAPH. People will actually stop us. We were filming, and quite often people would come up to us and say they really like the show. And the SIGGRAPH is, of course, where you guys tend to go, like where we tend to go. And so, of course, it's not unsurprising that we run into you, but the number of people that I did run into at SIGGRAPH that comment on how much they enjoyed the VFX show, we really, really appreciate it. And also, we know how many artists that work on the show also listen to us, and we feel slightly guilty if we criticize your shots, but by the same token, I think it's great to have a show that just focuses on the efforts of so many talented artists throughout the industry and now increasingly throughout the world. And did any of you guys get to the, oh, obviously you didn't, Jason, the Pixar user group meeting?
I didn't.
The RenderMan. No. One of the really interesting things of that, and I don't know how I can get access to this, but one of the things that RenderMan guys discussed is because RenderMan is the base upon which nearly all feature films are rendered in, most of them, they track the rate of film production by the number of licenses for the farms. So as film production soars, obviously the render licenses for the farms soar, and similarly in a recession or whatever, they'll go down. But they also track it geographically, and so they had some really interesting diagram showing, you know, like animated over time, how the licenses have distributed around the world. There's this amazing huge blip in New Zealand, which you can put to just one company, of course. but, you know, from this sort of completely California-centric thing. And I know I'm bringing this up because a lot of people that listen to the VFX show are obviously in California and in Hollywood and in the industry, but a lot aren't as well. Like 60% of the people that listen to this show are actually outside the USA. And I apologize for speaking a bit quickly and the accent, but I know a lot of you outside the USA do listen to the show. And I live outside the USA. I love having that kind of global perspective on things. So thank you guys so much for supporting the show. And thank you, Matt and Jason, for being with us again. Always a pleasure.
Pleasure.
Thanks.
Until next time, guys. See you.